In our study, we're continuing to talk about the history and geography of the Bible. We're in the period of the Exodus, the coming out of the land of Egypt. I would call your attention to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12, as we begin our study. In our study, as we talk about the coming out of the land of Egypt, we've talked about the plagues. We've talked about the institution of the Passover in chapter 12, and we noted that in chapter 12, in verse 26, that one of the functions of the Passover was to be an occasion to teach their children of the great things that God had wrought among them. When they would ask, "What mean ye by this service?" They were to explain that this is the sacrifice of Jehovah's Passover, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses. And the people bowed the head and worshipped, and the children of Israel went and did so. As Jehovah had commanded Moses and Aaron, so did they. I don't know that it's possible for us to over-exaggerate the importance of their teaching their children and utilizing such occasions as this to emphasize the great things that God did. We neglect that, brethren. They neglected that. And we see that as we come to another generation after them, we now have a people that has forgotten all about the great things that God did. After the death of Joshua, we come to the period of the judges. We'll talk about that when we get to that. But we have a people that has forgotten the things that God did. When we think of the things that these people have seen, they've seen the plagues brought upon Egypt. They've seen the distinction between the Egyptians and the Israelites. Seen darkness in the land of Egypt, except in the land of Goshen, where there was light. The children of the Egyptians, the firstborn, died of all that the Egyptians possessed. But that plague did not smite the children of Israel, where the blood of the lamb was present on the door and on the lintel above the door. The people then are permitted by Pharaoh to leave the land of Egypt. We come to the 14th chapter of the book of Exodus, where the children of Israel are coming out. And behind them, of course, Pharaoh has changed his mind once again, and he has pursued the children of Israel. Before them, there is the Red Sea, and behind them, of course, the Egyptians. And I want to call your attention to verse 10 of chapter 14, Exodus chapter 14, verse 10. It says, "And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto Jehovah. And they said unto Moses, Because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to bring us forth out of Egypt? Is it not this, or is not rather this, the word that we spake unto thee in Egypt, saying, Let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it were better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And Moses said unto the people, Fear ye not, stand still, and see the salvation of Jehovah, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. Jehovah will fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace." In the reading of this text, the people are perplexed. Question, why are they afraid? Haven't they seen God provide for them time and time again? Why are they so afraid? Randy? They've seen the power of the Egyptian army. Larry?
There were former prayers that I answered in the time the Lord didn't do them, and now they're in the point where they're going to think they're going to die, and they don't believe.
Right. They don't trust God. Bottom line, they just don't trust Him. Out of all the things that they've seen, they still don't believe that He can provide for them, or that He will. And we see this and shake our heads in amazement, but look at what Moses tells them. He said, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." Now that statement in itself is one we want to take pause and note. Stand still and behold the salvation of the Lord. Have you ever, I want to word this carefully, have you ever seen the state that we're in, of course, spiritually, separated from God, lost, and perhaps talked with people that believed, perhaps even you yourself, who believe there's something that we must do, but not exactly sure what, but yet feel compelled to do something. Got to do something. And not knowing what to do, we think that God is going to somehow mystically or miraculously superimpose something upon us that then we will know we're among the saved. And we get into the charismatic, the Pentecostal salvation experience, Calvinistic theories. Moses tells these people, if you don't know what to do, then what should you do? Stand still. Now that ought not be such a profound thing. But somehow we want to go forward. We're determined to go forward. What happens when we exercise that kind of determination? If you don't know what to do and you're determined to go forward, you're not going to do what's right. You'll go back.
No, I mean that's...
Go ahead.
No, to that next point, don't go forward, don't go back either. I mean, that's what they're talking about.
All right.
And the other thing as well is as they're going through, they feel that they have nowhere to go because on each side there's water. And as you go forward, there's so many people that are going forward, they don't think they're going to make it.
All right. Stand still and see the salvation of Jehovah, which he will work for you today. Now, interestingly enough, as you continue the reading of this text, chapter 14, in verse 15, Jehovah said unto Moses, "Wherefore criest thou unto me, speak unto the children of Israel, that they go forward, and lift up thy rod, and stretch out thy hand over the sea, and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go into the midst of the sea on dry ground. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall go in after them, and I will get me honor upon Pharaoh and upon all his host, upon his chariots and upon his horsemen, and the Egyptians shall know that I am Jehovah." Now, question, let's pause there. The Egyptians would know. Who else would know? The Israelites. You'll know that I am Jehovah. In the exercising of these plagues upon the Egyptians, one of the purposes was that Pharaoh's question, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice?" that he'll now understand who I am. But not just he will know, but that you will know. You see, God is compelling the Israelites to trust him. Do what I tell you to do. "Moses, lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go into the midst of the sea on dry ground." As you read further in this text, it tells us in verse 21 that Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and Jehovah caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all the night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. Now that tells us what God did. But can you in your wildest dreams imagine marching down the bank of the sea into what was the waters of the Red Sea and crossing on dry ground? This is what Moses is calling upon them to do. This element of trust, Larry, that we were talking about. Why are they crying unto the Lord crying unto Moses in verse 12 of this text? This is what we told you. Why didn't you just leave us alone? It's hard to trust, isn't it? Okay. John and then Larry, pick you up right after John.
Simple way, then are you able? So I'm sure they were thinking of that a bit.
Okay? Hold that thought. We're going to have to come back to that, because how long do lessons learned last? Larry and then Randy. That's right. This element of trust, we seem to forget about that. Here's what we know. We know that God has done these things to Egypt. He's turned water to blood. He's destroyed essentially every god that they worshipped. All of these plagues were against the gods of Egypt, as well as against Pharaoh, who purported to be a god, and against his son, who was purported to be the next god to be worshipped among these people. All gone. Alright? Randy?
Over in chapter 6, verse 9, for the plagues, it says, "So Moses spoke thus to the sons of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses on account of their despondency and their cruel bondage."
Alright.
I think what their overwhelming fear when they got to the Red Sea and saw the army, Southern Egyptian army coming, was going back to what they had, or being driven back to what they had. Speculation. I mean, they might have thought they were going to die as well. But it doesn't make sense that the Egyptian army would come out and slaughter them. They could have killed them while they were still in Egypt. If the Egyptian army was coming, it was probably coming to bind them again and take them back into bondage and use them as slaves again.
Yeah. Since they
had hope.
Well, perhaps, but you'd like to think that these plagues would have cultivated some very genuine hope.
The other thing was being butted up against the Red Sea and realizing there was no place to go. They didn't think, "Oh, God can drive us from the sea up so we can cross." That wasn't in their thoughts until it happened.
Yeah. I think the key there in what you said is they didn't think. But why? I mean, look at what they've had to think about during the time of all these plagues. God has proven His victory over the Egyptians in every respect. And even yet, they don't trust Him. And I think there's the lesson that we need to learn. We don't trust Him.
The question, in fact, Joey, I believe it was you Wednesday night who had the invitation. You were talking about loving God, having faith in God, and the relationship that that has to doing what God said, obedience. And there we drop the ball. We say, "Yes, I believe God. I believe what," but then I don't do what He said. We affirm, "Yes, I love the Lord," but then we don't do what He said. And in Kentucky, the expression, the proof of the pudding's in the eating. Indeed. If you believe what He says, and if you love Him, you do what He says. And that's what Jesus said. "If you love me, you'll keep my commandments." And that was the problem. Okay? Liam?
Like John said, I think I don't necessarily want to do what God says, but I have a problem, so I pray and I ask Him to fix it. I ask Him to fix it, number one, fix it. This is how I want it, and this is when I want it. And when it doesn't happen that way, because it seems like God answers prayers a yes, a no, or maybe not right now. And we don't want to take the no, and we don't want to take the not right now. And like you said, if you do what He says, and that's the other part of it, we don't necessarily want to do what He says. We just want Him to fix it magically.
Yeah, and that's not always the answer.
And I think maybe these people wanted Him to do it, but their way, as they thought.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, as we look back at this text in Exodus chapter 14, let's pick up the reading there at verse 19. It says, "And the angel of God, who went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud removed from before them and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was the cloud and the darkness, yet gave it light by night, and one came not near the other all the night." Now, what's happening during the night?
Pardon me?
God is protecting
them. He's protecting them. That's right. The Egyptians cannot approach the Israelites because God has built a barrier, as it were, between them. Now still, wherein is the trust? These people still have some fear that God's not going to do what He said that He will do. Let me see if I can make that work.
Well, he said He was going to give them this land, and now it's 400 years later, and it's a long time.
Yeah, yeah. But He also said, I'm going to give you everything that the Egyptians have, and they've got it. And the Egyptians, of course, are pursuing, but they don't have anything. All the silver, the gold, and the beautiful clothes, and all. The Israelites have it all, and God told them, you can just go take what you want. And that's what happened. But yet, they still don't believe that God's going to provide for them and care for them. And, of course, He does, to give them this land. We note that they gather in Ramesses and start across. They come to Succoth. And you're familiar with the text there. But as we drop down into verse 21, it tells us that by a strong east wind all the night and made the sea dry and the waters were divided, and the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass in the morning watch that Jehovah looked forth upon the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of cloud, and discomfited the host of the Egyptians, and He took off their chariot wheels, and they drove them heavily, so that the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for Jehovah fighteth for them against the Egyptians. Now, paint me a picture here, Richard. What's happening when Pharaoh seeks to follow the Israelites?
Well, the first thing is that the people are going over. This is what just shocks me no end. They're going over on dry ground. This area has been underwater since the end of the flood, however many hundreds, thousands of years ago. And now all of a sudden they're crossing on. They're not getting stuck in the mud. Mm-hmm. They're walking over on dry ground, just as they do at Jericho later on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Egyptians feel that it's okay to pursue them. And that is dry ground, shows that that's why they had their chariots. Otherwise, the chariots wouldn't have done any good. So, but God has caused their chariots to dismantle themselves. They're getting ready to flee by a foot or a horse or whatever that they can get. Get out of there.
All right. I like the way you said that. Their chariots are dismantling themselves. That's well put. Wheels are falling off. God calls the wheels fall off their chariots. Yeah.
It makes it a little bit easier to do there instead.
Okay. Yes, please.
Exodus 14. Where'd you start?
Well, the point that we're discussing, I think, is in verses 24 and 25.
In the morning watch, the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. He caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and He made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, let us flee from Israel, and the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians.
Okay, all right. So they're not so successful in driving their chariots into the Red Sea and following the Israelites. Indeed. They perceive that God is fighting for the Israelites. Now, as far as the course is concerned that Israel took as they left Egypt, as they crossed the Red Sea, as they wandered in the wilderness, we're dependent upon scholars' help to help us locate some of these places. I know, and you do too, I guess, from reading historical accounts, that the work of an archaeologist is very difficult to find something that would help him to identify a city, its location, and so forth. How much more difficult would it be to identify an encampment where a group of people may have spent the night or a few nights or perhaps a week or a few weeks over a period of 3,500 years history. You can appreciate the difficulty of that task. From our study forward, when we are talking about the location of some of these places, please understand that the location of some of these places is far from definite. And so to chart a dogmatic course where the children of Israel traveled would be difficult. There is a traditional route that is usually recognized and studied, which is in our lesson book. And that's the one that we're going to pursue because that's in our lesson book. The places, the events that happened there, are the things that we want to emphasize, not altogether simply the location of these, because the location can be difficult to prove. But we do want to note what occurred there. The first two camping places, we are told, one at Succoth, the other at Etham in chapter 13, in verse 20, as they make preparation to cross over the Red Sea to escape the Egyptians. But as we come to the conclusion of the 14th chapter, I want you to note in verse 28, it says, "The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even all the host of Pharaoh that went in after them into the sea. There remained not so much as one of them. But the children of Israel walked upon the dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. Thus Jehovah saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. And Israel saw the great work which Jehovah did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared Jehovah, and they believed in Jehovah and in his servant Moses." Two or three things I want to note in the reading of those few verses. One is that the army of Pharaoh was destroyed. All of them. It said there remained not so much as one of them. Now the Egyptians have attempted to pursue the Israelites in their chariots. The Israelites, it tells us, walked on dry ground in the midst of the sea. They didn't have chariots. They walked across. The second thing that I want us to note is that when the walls of water collapsed, the Israelites saw the dead bodies of the Egyptians upon the seashore. A third thing that I want us to note is that Israel saw the great work that God did, and they feared God, and they believed in God, and they believed in Moses. Now, John, here's your point. When they finally saw the collapse of Pharaoh's army, the text tells us that now they're not afraid. They believe in God. They believe in Moses as God's leader. Now, Donnie, you did a good job in the material that you showed me last week regarding the possible crossing places of the Israelites as they came up out of the land of Egypt. There are those who believe that they have found possible crossing places where the Israelites came out of Egypt. You don't see that on this particular map. In fact, let me find, I have it just a little bit ahead. It's not in the order that I'm presenting this material this morning, but I can find it readily, I think. Right there. We'll pass over that perhaps when we get to that. This shows us a Google Earth map of some possible crossings of the Israelites coming up out of the land of Egypt. Here, of course, is the land of Goshen, and this is the Gulf of Suez, and here is the Gulf of Aqaba. Some believe that the Israelites came down and crossed perhaps in this area and came down. Others believe that they came this way and crossed this portion of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba. And Diane, in the material that you were showing me, the scholar there believes that they came down this way and crossed perhaps here. Now, one of the reasons that the fellow Wright, I believe is his name, I may be wrong about that, but I believe his last name is Wright, believed that the crossing was here because there have been cameras that have been sent down to take pictures at the bottom of the Gulf of Aqaba, and it is believed that there are images of wheels, chariot wheels, on their axle. One, in fact, where coral have attached themselves or grown on that, which these photographs seems to indicate that chariots were on the bottom of the sea, this portion of the sea. And others counter that, and they say, no, it can't be so, because wooden chariot wheels would have decayed, and there would be no evidence that chariots crossed from pictures on the bottom of the sea, and so that just can't be true. Others have shown that the ancient Egyptians and royalty often had chariots that were made out of gold, and gold would not deteriorate on the bottom of the sea. And you can go online, as Diane did, and look at these and read these reports.
I think his name
is Rude. Is it R-O-O-D, Rude? It may be. I may be mistaken on that. I meant to write that in my notes, and I'm depending on memory, and that don't work so good sometimes. That may be. Pardon me? Oh, this is Rudd, Steve Rudd. Yes, this is his map, but the man that recognized the photographs here and allegedly took the photographs, I'm not certain of his name. Now, Steve Rudd didn't do this. He presented this material, but the research that he did notes the work of this other man with this particular crossing. Now, Steve Rudd believes that they crossed here, and he offers evidence on his website. You can go and read that to substantiate why he believes that they crossed here in the southern portion of the Gulf of Aqaba. But we're, for our purposes in study, we're going to use the crossing here because, number one, that's the approach that our lesson book takes. That's the traditional approach, and there are some other reasons as well. But we're going to follow that to avoid a lot of complications in our study. But I just want you to be aware that there are those who believe that they crossed over here because of photographs they think indicate the existence of chariot wheels and axles at the bottom of the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, all of that, having been said and done, I think helps us to see that the Egyptians were indeed destroyed. And in the 15th chapter of the book of Exodus, the writer tells us the Song of Miriam, where they recognize that the horse, the rider, the chariot, they will see no more. They're gone. God told them that they would be delivered of the Egyptians, and indeed they were. And they see them no more. I want to call your attention to verse 5 and verse 10. It tells us at verse 5, the deeps cover them. They went down into the depths like a stone. In verse 10, thou didst blow with thy wind. The sea covered them. They sank as lead in the mighty waters. Nehemiah mentions that also in Nehemiah chapter 9 and in verse 11. So the army of Pharaoh, in his stubbornness to pursue the Israelites, perished in the depths of the sea. Now, this map that I had up a few moments ago that also showed pictures of coral-covered chariot wheels, he also affirms that there are bones that he has taken photographs of. For what it's worth, you can go online and do that research yourself, but the bones found near the shoreline at the Gulf of Aqaba, which this tells us that they saw the
bodies of the Egyptians on the shoreline of the sea, beginning there in verse 28. So the people saw that God had gained victory over the Egyptian army. They're free. This is a great occasion to celebrate. Yes, Randy?
We don't have any evidence that Pharaoh was with his army, right?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. If you look at verse
let
me find it. Yeah, we're going to have to go later. When Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes and they saw the Egyptians. We look in verse 23, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and his horsemen. And then in verse 27, Jehovah overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Verse 28, even all the host of Pharaoh that went in after them into the sea. In verse 4, Pharaoh's chariots and his host hath he cast into the sea. Pardon me? 19, for the horses of Pharaoh went in with his chariots and with his horsemen into the sea. One other I want to check.
17 verse of chapter 14 says he'll be honored through Pharaoh and his army and his chariots and horsemen.
All right, there you go. There you go. Okay. Yes, I think there's evidence that's overwhelming that Pharaoh died as well. In verse 11 of Nehemiah 9, it says, "And thou didst divide the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and their pursuers did cast into the depths as a stone into the mighty waters." So Pharaoh and his mighty army, all gone. I think the evidence is that he led them into the depth of the sea.
So with him gone and his son dead, what are you to go?
Makes me wonder what there was to take over.
The army. Yeah, the
army's
gone.
Pardon me?
And the army's gone.
Army's gone.
So when the Egyptians were left, they must have found the bodies of their relatives on the seashore.
Well, we can only assume. Only a
I was going to ask you too. According to that last map you showed with different crossing possibilities, isn't Mount Sinai on the Sinai Peninsula?
Mount Sinai is on the Sinai Peninsula according to the traditional route of the Exodus. Mount Sinai is on the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba according to the accounts of some in the Arabian Desert. Not solid proof. No, I don't think so. No. There is the traditional understanding of where Mount Sinai is. Well, from what research I've done, the peninsula was named after the presumed location of Mount Sinai. So the naming of the Sinai Peninsula is after the mountain. But it was after it was presumed that this is the location of Mount Sinai. When we come over into the New Testament, the Apostle Paul talks about Mount Sinai in Arabia. That would be on that side of Aqaba. We'll have to talk some about that.
Yeah. When do we know for sure God has pointed to us? Because later years, Rahab knew all about it.
Knew all about it, yeah. Yeah, when they came into Jericho, she had already heard what God did, how they had crossed the Red Sea, how that all these armies had been defeated. That's right. That's right.
I was just going to mention, I did a just a quick look on Google Earth here as to the distance across the Gulf of Aqaba at the shortest, the narrowest point where they might have crossed. It's still almost 10 miles.
Yeah.
They'd have had to cross a 10-mile gap with the Egyptian army in hot pursuit behind them.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is doable.
We just don't know. You got 2 to 3 million people. We don't know how much waters were parted.
Never look at God's miracle. No man can redo that type of miracle. It's always been spectacular.
Yeah.
And so is this.
Yeah. You know, in the study, and I don't want to detour our class, and it's an interesting study when we talk about, well, if this is possible, if this is possible, and perhaps they've crossed here because of these circumstances. All of that is great as far as speculation is concerned. And that's what we're going to catalog it as speculation. We don't know the exact place where they crossed. We don't know the exact route that they took. We can look at this evidence and this evidence. Some have speculated that at some of these crossings, there was somewhat of a natural land bridge that was so deep under the water. Some have suggested that over at the Gulf of Aqaba, that we've got a depth in some of the deeper places that would have virtually made it almost impossible for them to cross there.
Well, 500 feet deep.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to suggest to you that when we talk about the history of the plagues, you think that God would be dependent upon a natural land barrier, that he'd have to part the waters there for them to be able to cross? I don't even want to pursue that argument. That's trying to explain how God did the miracle. We don't have to put that kind of condition upon it. Randy, and then Joey.
In fact, what we do know, we know that they camped in those two places.
Yes.
And the next day, they crossed.
Yes. So yes.
That kind of makes it possible for them to cross the entire Sinai Peninsula and gone to the other side.
You'd like to think that, yeah. You'd like to think that, but that would create a bit of a problem, wouldn't it? All right, Joey, and then back to John.
And that kind of thinking suggests that, you know, God can do easy miracles, but he can't do tough ones or big ones. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't want to even go there.
You know what I mean? I mean that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beyond the scope of our study. John?
So a lot of times I think we get the impression that the whole thing came apart and then the whole thing went back together. But I may be reading it wrong, but 14, 28, 29 says the waters returning covered the chariots and horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea got to them. Not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall on their right hand and their left. It almost sounds like they're walking through as Egypt is getting humbled at the same time.
Well, one could take that position, I suppose. It would sound that way, I mean.
All I'm saying is there's no need for it to all part and all come together at the same time, so the distance is, I think, total.
Yeah. Well, the point is, God destroyed the Egyptians. God delivered the Israelites. Juan?
I think at this point in time, I'd like to kind of think about how we always hear and we say that if this is doable, then it must be okay, or, you know, God's allowing it. But in this particular circumstance, the Egyptians are probably thinking the exact same thing. We can go through, and since there's an ability for us to go through and follow them, then it's what we're supposed to be doing, kind of thing. I think we do that to ourselves a lot. We sit there and say, oh, well, God's not stopping me, but he sometimes does let us go a little bit to where we're going to sit there and drown, and that's what we do. And so I bet the Egyptians felt the same way. This is what is happening, so we can do this.
Perhaps so. But what we see is God led the Israelites, and he separated the Israelites from the Egyptians, and he destroyed the Egyptians in the depth of the sea. They sank like a lead weight, and it was all over for them. Now, we note that when they came out, what did they bring with them? Joseph's bones. Why did they do that? Pardon me?
He asked them to.
Why did he ask them to bring his bones? What did Joseph know that God was going to do?
Let his people free.
Lead his people up out of the land of Egypt. Joseph knew that. And when that occurs, you bring my bones and bury me in the land that God has promised. Well, let's pursue just a little bit study of their exodus. You'll note that when they came out, the text tells us, with over 600,000 fighting men. In Exodus chapter 12, verse 26, we see the number 603,550 soldiers in Exodus chapter 38. This is where we get our number, perhaps 2 to 3 million people came up out of the land of Egypt. God had promised unto Abraham, I will make of thee a great nation. 2 to 3 million came from Abraham and Sarah when they were old and had no children. Finally, Isaac was born and the descendants began to multiply, and we see now the fulfillment of the promise that God had made. Now, when we look at the location of these travel ways on the map, the way of Shur and the way of the sea. We've talked about them especially as we get up into the land of Canaan. Here we've got the King's Highway going up on the east, the Transjordan side of the Jordan River Valley. And we think, well, coming out of here, it's really not all that far into the land of Israel. We mentioned when Joseph was sold into slavery, how far away really was he from his family?
A couple of hundred miles.
And by our standard today, that's not all that far. And perhaps we might think, well, that's a very long way when you talk about leading 2 to 3 million people across a barren wilderness. But yet we have travel paths across here or highways to transport the people from point A to point B. But evidently God chose not to do that. What was inevitable if they had continued on these highways? Trade routes.
They would meet bad people.
They would meet bad people. Yeah, that's put very well. They would meet bad people. And what are they now? They're a bunch of disorganized soldiers. What must they learn? Yes.
Millions of people coming is going to cause alarm to the people who live there.
Yes. Yes. And so what does God then do with these people? What becomes necessary? You said discipline, and right you are. Who's going to teach them discipline? What's been the problem so far? Why didn't they just depend upon Moses to lead them out when Moses first came from the land of Midian back to Egypt? They fussed at Moses. Why are you here? Leave us alone. Go away. And they're fussing at him now before they cross over the Red Sea. Why did you come back? This is what we told you about. Why didn't you just leave us alone?
Disbelief.
Lauren? No, we don't. And sometimes we don't look far enough back to remember. And they've forgotten. And they need to be reminded. And every generation needs to be frequently reminded. Bruce?
No, they made a statement that, that they were in bondage for over 400 years.
All right.
So you're looking at, even in that time, they were still saying you were never in bondage.
Well, that's true. Later in the days of Jesus, they affirmed that. But God needs to, at this point, educate these people to depend on Him, to trust Him. Now, when Pharaoh sends his army, let me get past these to where I want to be. We talked about that. This is where I want to be. Yes. Turn, if you will, to Exodus chapter 15. Exodus chapter 15. We've talked about the Song of Miriam, praising God for the deliverance. As you drop down to verse 22 of chapter 15, it says, "And Moses led Israel onward from the Red Sea. And they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah, bitterness. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, What shall we drink? And he cried unto Jehovah, and Jehovah showed him a tree, and he cast it into the waters, and the waters were made sweet.
And he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them, and said, If thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of Jehovah thy God, and wilt do that which is right in his eyes, and will give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases upon thee, which I have put upon the Egyptians, for I am Jehovah that healeth thee. Look at that carefully, beloved. What have they seen? 3 days before.
A huge miracle.
Yeah, if we can catalog it. They have seen the waters of the Red Sea part. They have seen Pharaoh and all of his army destroyed. And now 3 days down the pike, they're fussing and complaining because they don't have sweet water to drink. Any of you ever drink sulfur water? Terry has. Oh, he don't like it. Peggy has. He don't like it. When I grew up in Kentucky, it was not far from a place called Sulphur Well. It was a state park. And people would bring bottles and so forth there to get the mineral waters, thinking that this was good for them. And the water just bubbled up out of the ground, nice and cold and very, very distasteful, some thought. But at any rate, if you were thirsty, wouldn't water that didn't taste good be no water at all? Well, why fuss? It's bitter. We don't like it. I don't understand. They complained. And God provided a means by which to make the water sweet so the people could drink it, or so they would like it. Well, why would you not be able to drink it? Well, I don't know the answer to that. You might like to... Yeah. You might look that up and see if that word involves poison. All right.
The book I read, they said there were about four wells there that were alkaline. And the people who lived there said that's where Moses crossed, and he made the water sweet.
That's interesting.
So I don't know how true that is. That's the book that I read.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. But the people are fussing, is our point. And what does that indicate? A lack of trust of the provisions of God. They complained and God provided for them water. Now, admittedly, when I think of this area, I think of countries much like Jawbone Canyon and out where we went yesterday, Larry. And what would you do with 2 to 3 million people in a wilderness like that to provide food and water for them? But God did. And during this process, they're learning dependence upon God. And a very valuable lesson. We'll talk some more, course, about that next time.